All right, well, this is a class number 3 in our analysis of literature course for the second semester. And in the last class, we had mentioned that we would be looking at two questions again relating to Huckleberry Finn, the novel Huckleberry Finn, and then we will move into a consideration of the poetry of Chapter 7, and we will spend this class as well as then the next class looking at the poetry of Chapter 7. All right, then. Well, first of all, with respect to looking at two questions relating to Huckleberry Finn, it was questions number 19 and number 22 in that, and 19 asked this question. Huck Finn was not satisfied with the Widow Douglas' explanation of the purpose of prayer. How should we critique her explanation, and what would you have said if you were in such a situation? So the first part of this question is, what did the Widow Douglas say?
She said prayer was about spiritual gifts and being good to other people.
Okay, so she said that prayer was about spiritual gifts and about being good to other people. Now, what was the context in which she said this? What view did Huckleberry Finn seemingly have?
That it wasn't working.
Yes, his view is it didn't seem to be working. And so, in some sense, this was a response. Because what had he been asking for? What type of thing?
Like, he wanted a fish, so he wanted some hooks. But he didn't get some hooks, so his fishing line was useless.
All right, so he wanted, like, fishing hooks or whatever. All right, well, so that's what she said. How would you critique her response? How would you critique her response? And speak loudly. Was it an adequate and, you know.
I don't exactly understand what she meant, like how it even relates to what Huck was asking.
You don't see how it relates to what?
How, I mean, being good to other people, that's not exactly what. How does that even have to do with Huck's question of why prayer wasn't working?
So you don't, I mean, your answer then is you don't feel it was an adequate response.
No.
All right. What about, any other thoughts on this?
Well, I don't think, she's sort of saying is the reason you're not getting it is because the only thing you can really pray for is spiritual gifts.
Right. She's saying,
that's what I understood.
Yes, that what you need to be praying for is spiritual gifts. Not material things such as fish hooks. So that was her response. Mm-hmm. All right. And now Parnell has argued that that is not an adequate answer. What any other thoughts on that? What should she have said if you don't feel that was an adequate answer?
Well, really with anything, you don't know that you're going to get what you want, even if you pray for it. So, it's not like, even with spiritual gifts, that you'll get everything. And so, it's really not, like with prayer, that it's just a way of getting what you want. Because you won't necessarily get it.
Alright, so, but of course Huck Finn would say, well, if you can't get what you want with it, then why is it useful? How would you respond to that rebuttal if he had made that argument. Because that was somewhat what he was thinking anyway, right?
Well, God says you should do it. And sometimes God does use it.
Right. Okay, so part of the answer to Huckleberry Finn would be say that God commands it of us. That's one thing. And that when you're in an army and the general says to march, you march. Even if that march is just for whatever, you know, you're not marching to fight the enemy. So part of it, well, it's a command. So that's part of the answer. What else? Doesn't it say the effectual, the prayer of a righteous man is effectual? Something, I'm paraphrasing here, but what does that mean?
Well, God hears it, so he might answer it the way you want. Of course, he might not, but...
Right. So there is this element in prayer that that it is always, you know, there is the implicit or explicit phrase, if the Lord wills. So it's always contingent upon what one is asking is what he plans to implement and do. So it is always contingent in that sense. But on the other hand, now is there any element of truth to what the Widow Douglas said? Because aren't there some things that we know we should pray for and know we should seek to get? And what is that? How does that relate back to what the Widow Douglas said? I mean, in other words, for fishhooks, I mean, it may not be what, right? I mean, but aren't there some things that we can know God would have us to have? Or no?
Yes.
Like what?
Well, like being good to other people.
Okay, so there are some things, and the prayers in those situations, when a Christian prays for it, it is indeed. I mean, when we are praying for something that we know that he requires of us, then this can be a great means to attaining those. So there's certainly a large element of truth in what the Widow Douglas said, I would think.
However, I don't think it's right that you just pray for your spiritual gifts, because in the Lord's Prayer, it says, give us this day our daily bread.
Right, right. That's...
So we can ask for earthly, earthly things.
Yes. And so that part of her response was inadequate, because we can't ask for earthly things, but just with the understanding that it's there is this contingency, in other words, that the Lord may not, want...
Even Christ prayed that, let this cup pass from me. You know, when he was struggling in the Garden of Gethsemane, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, not my will, but your will be done. Also, the verse that says, cast all your cares upon me.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's question 19 that we wanted to discuss. Question 22 asks this, what notion did Huck Finn have about providence? And why did he prefer Widow Douglas's version over that of Miss Watson?
I'm not exactly sure if he really had any firm view about providence. It seemed to me like he was kind of really... Well, I know that Widow Douglas's idea of providence made his mouth water or something. Then Miss Watson made him really...
So what do you think? I mean, obviously, he had some idea of what he at least thought it was, because how else could he have said he liked Widow Douglas's version of it? So he had a notion. The question is, what was his notion? What was his notion of providence? Because he said he liked it. If I say I like something, that means I must have a notion of it. Now, that might be an incorrect notion of it, but it's still a notion. He has a notion of what he thinks it is. So what notion did he have of providence?
He probably thought that providence was nice, but that providence really didn't need him, so he really didn't need to worry about it.
Okay, but why did he like Widow Douglas's version of providence?
Because he was more... Her version was more nice, not as judgmental or whatever.
What notion do you think he precisely had of it?
I think Widow Douglas's, under her version of providence, he would do quite well, but with Miss Watson, he was kind of stuck.
Just in terms of personality, what was Widow Douglas like versus Miss Watson? In terms of personality, did you get a sense of what Widow Douglas was like from the novel?
Widow Douglas was more, she came across as more caring, but Miss Watson came across as more stern.
That's right.
Yes.
I agree.
Miss Watson was more strict and stern, and Widow Douglas was more lenient to Huck Finn. And so it would seem from the context that Widow Douglas probably said something as far as God's providence being, she's probably spoke of it in terms of being more, as you say, more positive, in the sense of she probably emphasized how God decrees things that come to pass, and that those things she probably put a more positive spin on things that come to pass, whereas perhaps Miss Watson put a more, what at least Huck Finn construed as, negative spin. Of course, what would Huck Finn consider negative?
Well, he wouldn't like the idea of God judging people.
Right. Judging and putting crimp on his lifestyle that he wanted to lead. All right then, well that goes back to chapter 6, but now we're going to, unless there are any more questions about chapter 6, move on to chapter 7 and the poetry of chapter 7. Are there any further questions before we move into chapter 7? Okay, well, with respect to chapter 7, your written assignment due by the class, two classes from now, are questions 26. They're questions 26, 34, 35, 57, 59, and 81. So again, that's 26, 34. I'm going to take out question 35, not question 35. Question 26, 34, 57, 59, and 81. Now for question 26, write a one-page paper answering the question. For question 34, this only requires a few sentence answer. Question 57, prepare a list, answer the question. Question 59, another list to answer the question. And in question 81, write a paragraph to answer the question. So again, it's questions 26, write a paper. Question 34, a few sentence answer. Questions 57 and 59 each require a list. And question 81, a paragraph. Okay, so those are the written work you will do for chapter 7. Now we're going to begin to look at the other questions about the reading. So we're going to now begin this. And again, our goal is to do some of it this morning, and then, in this class, and then the remainder in the next class. All right, let's begin then with the poem On the Raven by Edgar Allan Poe with this question. In The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, what month of the year is it, and what time of the day is it, and how do these suit the tone of the poem?
It was December, and I believe around midnight.
Okay, so it's December and around midnight. And how do these suit the tone of the poem?
Well, it was sort of, the poem was dark and cold.
Well, what is actually, question number two is, what is the tone of the poem?
It was, it's sort of ominous, dreary and ominous, and then it turns to sort of despondent.
Mm-hmm. So, despondent. Melancholic, despondent. So why then does, so December and around midnight, why do those suit then the tone of dreariness and melancholy?
Because it's dark and around midnight and cold in December.
Yeah, cold and dark and all the leaves have fallen. All right.
We're getting to that point.
All right. Does the setting of the poem change within the poem?
No.
What is the setting of the poem? And not in terms of time, but in terms of location.
He's inside his, like, apartment or chamber.
Yes, that's right. All right, how is the narrator feeling before the visitor came a-tapping? How is the narrator feeling?
Weak and weary.
Yes, weak and weary. Why is he weak and weary?
Someone had died.
Someone? Who is the someone?
Lenore.
Lenore. And who is Lenore? Was that his grandmother?
I don't know. Probably someone he was quite close to.
Okay. Someone he was close
someone
to.
Someone he wanted to marry.
All right. There we're getting closer here. Someone he wanted to marry. All right. So it's apparently a woman that he loved. And what has happened to her then?
She died.
Yes. And so is that why she's called the Lost Lenore?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the narrator doing to try to take his mind off Lenore at the beginning of the poem, according to the beginning of the poem?
He's reading books of forgotten lore.
He's reading books of forgotten lore.
It's interesting, everything rhymed, and yet, you know, it was so beautiful, and yet there was so clear a picture of what he wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
Lenore, folklore.
All right, so he's reading a volume of forgotten lore to take his mind off the lost Lenore. All right. What does the narrator think the tapping noise is at first?
He thinks it's a visitor, and then he thinks it's no one.
Yes. 'Tis some visitor, I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. only this and nothing more. Okay. What is the narrator's reaction when the bird speaks for the first time?
He's amazed.
Why do you think he'd be amazed? Don't birds normally speak? No, he's amazed. He's amazed. Okay. How did the bird learn to say the word that he said?
Well, the person for a while thought it was because his owner had said nevermore a lot, so that's the only word he caught on.
Okay, so presumably it was...
Do ravens normally talk? I mean, like, I don't mean talk, like parrots can enunciate, but can ravens enunciate?
I don't think so. If anyone has another view, I don't think... What, don't ravens go like, haw, haw, that type of thing? Something along those lines. I don't know the ravens, what word did he know?
Nevermore.
Nevermore. Yeah, parrot.
Lori, do you know?
What, John?
Do you know if ravens can enunciate like parrots?
I have never heard that.
No, not me either.
Okay, well, this is a special raven. All right.
Yes, I can call it Paul.
Yeah. All right, so, what was the color of the raven?
Black.
Black. Anyway, okay. So, this raven apparently knew the word nevermore that the narrator of this poem attributes to having been trained by some master. Now, what was the master's mood to have trained it to say this?
Rather negative.
Yeah, rather melancholic. All right. Okay. Now, what does the narrator think about the bird's eyes? You remember, what does the raven think? I mean, what does the narrator think about the bird's eyes?
He talks about the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore.
Do you see? I mean, there's a specific statement made as far as the raven's eyes. Well, I will give you the answer, and then maybe sometime you can see if you can find it. He says they gave the bird demonic qualities. And that is what is said about the raven's eyes.
Do you remember the short story that we read by Edgar Allan Poe?
Yeah.
About the evil eye?
Mm-hmm. So that's something that Poe apparently focused upon. And, all right. What does the narrator call, do you see it?
Yes.
Where, read it.
He says, his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming.
Is dreaming. Okay, there you go. All right.
Called the bird's eyes fiery eyes.
Okay, fiery too.
Page 46.
Okay. All right. The all right. So, let's see here. What? Why does the narrator call the bird a wretch? He calls the bird a wretch. Why does he become, you know, the question is, why does he start becoming very unhappy with this bird?
Well, he thought it was sort of an omen of bad things. So, and in constantly seeing Nevermore, is answering his questions.
All right. Well, I would say to this question, because he connects its appearance and message with the lost Lenore, it's telling him, you know, that what he doesn't want to hear with respect to the lost Lenore. Now, in sort of in following up about what you just said, Calvin, why does the narrator ask the bird if there is life after death?
Because he wants to know whether he'll meet Lenore again.
Well, okay, he wants to know, but why would he pose that to this bird? What has he come to think about this bird? You had just said it.
He thinks that bird, in some sense, answers his questions.
All right. In some sense, that this bird he thinks is a prophet. Where does the narrator think the bird comes from?
From the demons, I guess.
Well, what does it say literally in the poem? I will tell you,
it's from the nightly shore, the Plutonian shore. Is that like...
Now, when it says Plutonian shore there, is it talking about the planet Pluto? Or I guess, is it a planet anymore? I guess. But what is it talking about, Plutonian shore? What does this tell us about Edgar Allan Poe? Where do you think he got this term?
Was that a part of Greek mythology?
Okay.
Could you say that over, please?
Was that a part of Greek mythology, I think?
Oh, okay.
Yes, he is drawing upon Greek and Roman mythology. And Edgar Allan Poe undoubtedly was very familiar with Greek and Roman mythology. And probably it's the case that people used to be more read with respect to ancient Greek and Roman literature. And this is an allusion to that. So he is drawing upon his knowledge. Now, how does that get back even to what the narrator was reading to at the beginning of the poem?
He's reading ancient literature.
Yes, of what lore?
Forgotten lore.
There you go. So this narrator, it's not just that Edgar Allan Poe is familiar with forgotten lore, so-called, but the narrator, it fits in with the narrator that he would speak of the Night's Plutonian Shore.
What is the Night's Plutonian Shore in Greek mythology?
It's essentially hell. You know, that's where, because there was, and again, as even when we were studying ancient Greek literature or Roman literature, or, Nordic literature, you know, the whole thing here is there were elements of truth in it, and very likely passed down from the people's ancestors, including Noah. And so there were elements of truth. They were unquestionably passed down even from Noah, that there was going to be a judgment day, and that there was a good place to go and a bad place that one could go after death, and so on and so forth. Now these were embellished upon and so forth as time went by, but and then even false ideas brought into it, but there were certainly elements of truth as well, and so that's what we see here. Okay. Does the narrator think he'll feel better if the bird goes away?
Well, he tells him to go away, so yes.
Okay. And that's an understandable answer, but does he believe if the bird goes away that his problems will go away?
No.
No, so he has a mixed feeling about this bird. And in some sense, what is the positive thing, getting back to even a question we had earlier answered, what is the positive thing this bird brings to the narrator, from the narrator's perspective? Again, what does he think the bird is?
A prophet.
So, you know, he has mixed feelings about this bird. And he does say that the shadow over his soul will never depart, no matter whether the bird goes or comes or whatever. The narrator sat on a chair with velvet violet lining and thought that she shall press on nevermore. Who is the she in this thought?
Lenore.
That's right.
I didn't understand that.
You don't understand what?
What it meant, you know, that he was sitting on this velvet-covered chair, and that she would press on evermore.
Nevermore.
Oh, she would.
She would not be there.
Oh.
That's how I interpret it.
Okay.
It says, but on the cushion's velvet violet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, nevermore. In other words, she would never be sitting on it. That's how I take it.
Okay.
All right. Why does the narrator ask the raven, is there balm in Gilead? Why does the narrator ask this? Is there balm in Gilead?
Well, he wants to know if there will be any comfort for him.
What is...
Of course, that's from the Bible.
Very good.
Okay.
You know what a bomb is, like a live bomb. Really, a balm is like an ointment.
Yes. What is balm in Gilead a reference to?
Well, in the Bible, it's a reference to Christ.
Well, let's first of all deal with what the literal. We were just saying, what is literally a balm in Gilead?
I think it was one of the products of Gilead, like one of the things that it would export.
Okay, yes, this is the technical information about it. The region of Gilead was noted for its balm, a secretion of the balsam tree. The territory where the balm came from, an area north of the Salt Sea in the land of Israel, was originally given by God to Manasseh as an inheritance when the children of Israel entered the promised land. The balm was used in various healing mixtures and was sold to many countries, especially Egypt. For instance, in Jeremiah 8:22, it says, "Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is not the health of the daughter of my people recovered?" Jeremiah 8:22. So, now, getting on to what Parnell was mentioning, what does this have to do then with, you mentioned it has to, it's a reference to the Messiah, Jesus Christ, Parnell. Mm-hmm. Why do you say that? And where is that reference made, for example, outside of this poem?
Well, I forget where in the Bible.
Well, I just read to you Jeremiah 8:22. First of all, there is no necessary within the Bible saying the balm in Gilead equals Jesus Christ. All right, I'll just tell you that right now. But where is this connection explicitly, well, pretty clearly made outside of this poem? And I'm not saying, in my opinion, it's with good basis, but it is with good basis, I think. But where do we hear this reference?
I think you mentioned there's a hymn.
Okay, there is a hymn. Are y'all familiar with the hymn?
No.
I believe it's a black spiritual. It's there is a balm in Gilead. The tune is more, there is a balm in Gilead. Anyway, this is a black spiritual. And so he is making an allusion both to the black spiritual song, which the Americans would have been very familiar with at the time. In addition, you know, but ultimately it's a reference to the Bible. Even the statement like from Jeremiah 8:22, is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Well, who is called the great physician in the Bible?
Jesus Christ.
Right. So, you know, putting two and two together, it's understandable why even the term balm of Gilead would, in some sense, I mean, he is the balm of Gilead. He is the great physician. All right. So anyway, we see here Edgar Allan Poe's knowledge as well as the narrator of this poem, the imaginary narrator's awareness of these things. And so he's saying that, you know, there cannot be comfort found. Okay. Now it says, here is this. What is distant Aden that the narrator refers to? He refers to a distant A-I-D-E-N-N.
Is that a reference to Eden?
Eden. That's correct. a paradise which is a distant Eden. Why did the narrator want the raven then to depart?
It was not giving him good answers that he liked.
Yes, it was not. It kept answering back the same sorrowful answer. At the end of the poem, the narrator seems resigned. To what is the narrator resigned?
That his soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore.
Uh-huh.
The shadow of the bird?
That the raven will remain, and that he shall be melancholic evermore due to the loss of Lenore, is what I would say. So he's not going to get back Lenore, and he's going to be melancholic. Now, it is appropriate to grieve for the loss of a loved one, but the question is the poet's response to the death of Lenore biblically appropriate?
Well, it's not true that you'll always have to be despondent because of a death.
No, that is correct. This poet's, the narrator's response is, while one should certainly, it's very understandable that he should be sad at the loss of a loved one, he should be resigned to a melancholic frame for, you know, evermore is not a biblical response.
On the other hand, different personalities have different tendencies. You know, some people get over things quickly and some don't.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's no excuse still to wallow in it. Now, we don't know, was the death more recent or was it...
Well, you know, but even if it was more recent, the position that I'm going to, for the rest of my life, be melancholic is not a biblical...
That's right.
It might say, well, you know, of course I'm going to be sad. And when I think about it, but that doesn't mean I'm going to spend my whole life in melancholy.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Poe had an extensive vocabulary, which is obvious to the readers of both his poetry as well as his fiction. Sometimes this meant introducing words that were not commonly used. In The Raven, the use of ancient and poetic language seems appropriate, since the poem is about a man spending most of his time with books of forgotten lore. What are some words in the poem that reflect an extensive vocabulary of ancient and poetic language?
He uses the word nepenthe.
Nepenthe. Yes, and that particular word is a potion used by ancients to induce forgetfulness of pain or sorrow. So that's one of the terms that he used. And how does that fit in? How does that seem appropriate within the context of this poem that he would use that term, nepenthe, a potion used by ancients to induce forgetfulness of pain or sorrow? How is it used in this poem, nepenthe?
Well, he's wondering whether he'll ever be able to forget.
Right. Okay, any others? We've actually already mentioned some of these. What are some others? We've already mentioned them,
actually.
Plutonian, that's right. Characteristic of Pluto, the god, the so-called god of the underworld in Roman mythology.
Even the ancient name of Eden, you know, Eden.
Eden, that is an Arabic word for Eden or paradise, so he used the Arabic word for it. Seraphim and the 14 first perfume by an unseen censer. A seraphim is one of the six winged angels standing in the presence of God in the book of Isaiah in the Bible. Okay. Yes. Now, symbols are often an important element in poetry. What is the raven a symbol of?
The reality that isn't so appealing.
Any thoughts from your standpoint?
It sort of represents, it's sort of an ominous representation of his despondent future.
Okay. So it has, you know, what is a raven associated with in terms of just literature historically? A black raven.
It's ominous.
Yes, it's, you know, this whole, there are superstitious elements to this, aren't there? Like, what is another animal that, you know, if someone sees that, you know, they think that it's an ill omen according to superstition?
A black cat?
A black cat, that's right. So, you know, but of course, why did he not use a black cat as opposed to a raven? Why do you think he used... He could have used a black cat, I guess, that squeezes between the door and the...
Or keeps on meowing by the door.
Yeah. But no, the raven obviously is a symbol that Poe decided to use. Another, on this whole theme of symbol, what is the chamber where the poem's narrator resides a symbol of, do you think?
When it says chamber, does he mean bedroom, right? Yes, I think when they say the word chamber...
It means sort of like a studio apartment, right?
A studio apartment? No, Calvin.
Okay.
You're kidding.
Well, it's sort of like that. I just thought, that's what I thought. Chamber.
A chamber during those times was your bedroom.
I actually tend more along Calvin's idea. That,
a studio apartment.
I think it's the place where he resides. But, I mean, it's not looking to one... It's not like saying the living room or the dining room. It's talking about... I mean, I think of it this... And again, one could say, well, what does this place look like? But, you know, where he resides. Keep in mind here... This is not a modern apartment, right? What is the image you have in your mind of this room? You know, do you consider that his apartment has a lot of rooms in it, or what would you imagine it to be like?
Kind of small.
And yeah, one room. Remember, this was a time too that there were a lot of people who lived in one room houses even. It's hard for us to imagine, but when they on the frontier, you know, that you sometimes would even have, you know, you have a bed over here, and I'm not saying that the richer people did, or the more developed, but this is quite possibly, you know, so anyway, what do you think then, so this is the place where he resides, what do you think his chamber is then a symbol of?
His current situation.
What, any other thoughts? How many people live in this chamber?
Well, just him.
Yes, just him, and then his one addition of who?
The raven.
The ill omen raven. Yeah. So here is what one person has thought. The chamber in which the narrator is positioned is used to signify the loneliness of the man and the sorrow he feels for the loss of Lenore. The room is richly furnished and reminds the narrator of his lost love, which helps to create an effect of beauty in the poem. What do you think about the tempest outside?
I think it's it just makes the setting more dark and miserable.
Okay, now as I said, on your assignment is you have to do number 26, so I'm going to skip that one. We have seen in Poe's The Raven, well, let me look and see here what we whether we will move to the next. I think we will reserve the remaining poems for let's go on. Let's try to do Winter Nightfall. And then let's try to do Winter Nightfall here. Question, or at least begin it. The Winter Nightfall in Bridges' poem is also a symbol. What do you think it is a symbol of?
The elderly man's coming death.
The what?
Elderly man's impending death.
Yes, the elderly man's impending death. Again, winter. We have seen in Poe's The Raven how the time of day and season of the year set the tone for the poem. How is this also then true for Winter Nightfall?
Well, you know, winter is kind of everything dies.
Uh-huh. So the idea of the death. Now, of course, in the poem by Poe, it was more dealing with Lenore, but in this particular case, it is dealing with the main subject. Let me just briefly read biographical information about Robert Bridges. He was an English poet noted for his technical mastery of prosody and for his sponsorship of the poetry of his friend Gerard Manley Hopkins. Born into a prosperous family, Bridges went to Eton College and then to Oxford. His edition of Hopkins' poetry then appeared in 1916. From 1869 until 1882, Bridges worked as a medical student and physician in London hospitals. So what we have here is a gentleman who lived towards the latter part of the 1800s and early 1900s. And just some additional information about his friendship, Robert Bridges' friendship with a man by the name of Hopkins. We are fortunate to have an article in this issue by a writer widely and justly admired for his fiction and essays. Hansen provides an illuminating contrast between the religious indifference of Bridges. So Bridges was a man who was religiously indifferent, and indifference in many ways characteristics of the broader culture in which he lived, and the profound religious development of Hopkins. Bridges in his development reflected the influence of a culture that had become almost hostile to religion, while Hopkins formed in fundamental ways by his conversion to Catholicism, found himself out of touch with the dominant tendencies of his day.
When did he live again?
Again, towards the latter part of the 1800s. And just in terms of background here, there was a movement at Oxford called the Oxford Movement, in which many Anglicans basically adopted more Roman...
Are you talking about Oxford University?
Oxford University in England. Went over to more Roman Catholicism, or at least Anglo-Catholicism, and that is what Robert Bridges' friend Robert Bridges' friend did. But in the case of his friend Gerard Manley Hopkins, but in the case of Robert Seymour Bridges, who composed this poem, the second poem we're looking at, he probably fit in more with the dominant trend of scholars at the time and later in terms of becoming more of a secular humanist. So here is my question. How does it seem Bridges' religious perspective, as described then here, manifests itself in his poem, Winter Nightfall? And this will be the last question, and we'll stop. And we'll take up this poem next class. How does his religious perspective seem to come through in this poem?
It's sort of just this man is just on his own, just going through life.
Mm-hmm. What did the Apostle Paul say in 1 Corinthians about death? Do you remember? Especially I'm thinking of 1 Corinthians 15.
Like, for Christians, it doesn't have a sting anymore.
Right.
It's
death, where is... Yes, where is thy victory, and why? What was the theme of 1 Corinthians 15? What was it speaking about?
The resurrection.
The resurrection. And how does that contrast with Bridges' view here of death?
It seems to just be the end.
The end, that's right. And like I've just mentioned here, Bridges was more of a secular humanist, and so life, when it ends on this earth, is the end. And that would seem to be what this poem is conveying. But we will take up that more. If there aren't any other questions, we will finish considering this poem as well as the remaining poems of the chapter, hopefully in the next class. Any other questions before we close today's class? All right, well, then that concludes today's class.